what never did and perhaps never will happen. His convictions on this score only deepened and hardened over the years. But from the start, he believed that militia were only peripheral supplements to the hard core, which needed to be a professional army of disciplined troops, who, like him, signed on for the duration. His model, in effect, was the British Army. This, of course, was richly ironic, since opposition to a standing army had been a major source of colonial protest during the pre-war years. To those who insisted that a militia army was more compatible with revolutionary principles, Washington was brutally frank. "Those principles can only flourish," he insisted, "if we win the war. And that can only happen with an army of regulars." Another significant development occurred on his way to Cambridge, an event less conspicuous than the Battle of Bunker Hill, but with even more far-reaching implications. Both the New York and the Massachusetts legislatures wrote congratulatory letters addressed to His Excellency, which soon became his official designation for the remainder of the war. To be sure, His Excellency is not quite the same thing as His Majesty, but throughout the summer and fall of 1775, even as delegates to the Continental Congress struggled to sustain the fiction that George III remained a friend to American liberty, poets and balladeers were already replacing the British George with an American version of the same name. In October 1775, the African-born slave and poet Phyllis Wheatley sent Washington her lyrical tribute, which concluded, "A crown, a mansion, and a throne that shine with gold unfading, Washington, be thine." Washington wrote Wheatley to express his thanks, the only occasion in his correspondence when he directly addressed a slave. The public disavowal of George III that Tom Paine launched with Common Sense in January 1776, and that Thomas Jefferson then made official in the Declaration of Independence the following July, destroyed George III as the singular symbol of authority for American subjects in the British Empire. The obvious, indeed the only personal replacement as the new symbol of authority for American citizens in the nascent, yet-to-be-named nation, was Washington. Unlike European monarchs, the source of his authority was neither biological nor spiritual, that is, divine right, but rather the purity of his revolutionary credentials. He was not an accident of blood. He had chosen and had been chosen. When General Gage questioned the legitimacy of his rank, Washington responded in a letter that was widely circulated in the American press. "You affect, sir, to despise all rank not derived from the same source with your own. I cannot conceive any more honorable than that which flows from that uncorrupted choice of a brave and free people, the purest source and original fountain of all power." This new semi-royal status fit in the grooves of his own personality and proved an enduring asset as important politically as the Custis inheritance had been economically. The man who was obsessed with control was now the designated sovereign of the American Revolution. The man who could not bear to have his motives or personal integrity questioned was assured that he enjoyed more trust than any American alive. The British would change commanding general four times. Washington was forever. Certain deficiencies in his character, aloofness, a formality that virtually precluded intimacy, were now regarded as essential byproducts of his special status, indeed, expressions of his inherent dignity. and the man who had bristled at the presumptive condescension of British officers and officials was now in charge of the military instrument designed to obliterate the British Army and all vestiges of British power in North America. In sum, his new status as His Excellency gave him the starring role in a historical drama that seemed tailor-made for him. On the other hand, the political and even psychological ramifications of his public role did require some personal adjustments. In August 1775, he made several critical comments about the lack of discipline in the New England militia units under his command, and described New Englanders in general as an exceedingly dirty and nasty people. As a mere Virginia planter, such expressions of regional prejudice would have been unexceptional. But as the symbolic spokesman for what were still being called the United Colonies, the comments created political firestorms in both the Massachusetts legislature and the Continental Congress. When Joseph Reed, a Philadelphia lawyer who served briefly as Washington's most trusted aide-de-camp, apprised him of the hostile reaction, Washington expressed his regrets for the indiscretion. "I will endeavor at a reformation, as I can assure you, my dear Reed, that I wish to walk in such a line as will give most general satisfaction." By nature, a reserved and self-contained personality, Washington was discovering that his new public obligation to be all things to all men required him to suppress even the smallest residue of private opinion that might otherwise leak out. Several months later, when Reed reported that the gossip machines in the Continental Congress continued to produce whisperings about regional prejudice against New England, Washington again vowed, "to make my conduct coincide with the wishes of mankind as far as I can consistently." But it was not easy, even for him, to extinguish completely his personal thoughts and feelings. "I have often thought," he complained to Reed, "how much happier I should have been if, instead of accepting of a command under such circumstances, I had taken my musket upon my shoulder and entered the ranks, or had retired to the back country and lived in a wigwam." Even within what he called my family, Washington needed to remain circumspect because his family meant the staff and aides-de-camp at his headquarters. We know that Billy Lee, his mulatto servant, accompanied him on foot and on horseback at all times, brushed his hair, and tied it in a queue every morning. But no record of their conversations has survived. We know that Martha joined him at Cambridge in January 1776, as she would at winter quarters during all subsequent campaigns. But their correspondence, which almost surely contained the fullest expression of personal opinion Washington allowed himself, for that very reason was destroyed after he died. The bulk of his correspondence during the war years, so vast in volume and officious in tone that modern-day readers risk mental paralysis, was written by his aides-de-camp. It is therefore the expression of an official, composite personality, usually speaking a platitudinous version of revolutionary rhetoric. For example, here are the general orders for February 27, 1776, when Washington was contemplating a surprise attack on the British defenses. "It is a noble cause we are engaged in. It is the cause of virtue and mankind. Every temporal advantage and comfort to us and our posterity depends upon the vigor of our exertions. In short, freedom or slavery must be the result of our conduct. There can therefore be no greater inducement to men to behave well." The inflated rhetoric concluded with the more candid warning that anyone attempting to retreat or desert will be instantly shot down. aware of his own limited formal education, Washington selected college graduates who were penmen as aides, whose facility with language assured that the grammar and syntax of his correspondence was worthy of His Excellency. His most trusted aides, Joseph Reed was the first, followed by Alexander Hamilton and John Lawrence later in the war, became surrogate sons who enjoyed direct access to the general in after-dinner sessions, when Washington liked to encourage conversation as he ate nuts and drank a glass of Madeira. Part extended family and part court, these favored aides traded influence for total loyalty. "It is absolutely necessary, therefore, for me to have persons that can think for me," Washington explained, "as well as execute orders." The price for what he called his unbounded confidence was their equally unbounded service to his reputation. It was understood as a matter of honor that they would write no revealing memoirs after the war, and none of them did. His other family was the cast of senior officers that assembled around him during the siege of Boston. 28 generals eventually served under Washington in the Continental Army over the course of the war. Almost half of them were present at Cambridge in 1775 and 76. A full accounting of even that smaller group, interesting though it may be, would carry us down twisting side roads and astray of our proper objective, which is Washington himself. Four of Washington's chief lieutenants, Charles Lee, Horatio Gates, Nathaniel Greene, and Henry Knox, provide the outline of the prevalent patterns that would shape his treatment of high-ranking subordinates. Lee and Gates were both former officers in the British Army, with greater professional experience than Washington. Charles Lee was a colorful eccentric. The Mohawks had named him Boiling Water for his fiery temperament, which at Cambridge took the form of threats to place all deserters on a hill as targets within musket shot of British pickets. Lee presumed a greater familiarity with Washington than his other generals, addressing him as "My dear General," rather than "His Excellency." He also questioned Washington's preferred strategy of engaging British regulars on their own terms in a European-style war, preferring guerrilla tactics and a greater reliance on militia. Lee also liked to make conspicuous displays of his irreverence toward military etiquette, was forever disheveled in his appearance, and was often seen conversing with his ever-present pack of dogs, again, the exact opposite of Washington's dignified formality. Horatio Gates was called Granny Gates because of his advanced age, he was 50, and the wire-rimmed spectacles dangling from his nose. He cultivated a greater familiarity with his troops than Washington thought appropriate, and, like Lee, favored a greater reliance on militia. Gates thought that Washington's plan for an assault on the British garrison in Boston was pure madness, and, given his experience, felt free to speak out for a more defensive strategy in several councils of war. Both Lee and Gates ended up colliding with Washington later in the war and becoming early exhibits of the primal principle of Revolutionary-era politics. Cross Washington and you risk ruination. Greene and Knox were both inexperienced amateurs, drawn to military service by their zeal for American independence. Nathaniel Greene was a Rhode Island Quaker, eventually called the Fighting Quaker, who was cast out of the Society of Friends because of his support for the war. He volunteered to serve in a local militia company, the Kentish Guards, at the rank of private, but ascended to Brigadier General within a year on the basis of his obvious intelligence and disciplined dedication. By the end of the war, especially during the Carolina campaigns, he demonstrated strategic and tactical brilliance. He was Washington's choice as successor if the great man went down in battle. At Cambridge, however, Greene was described as the rawest, the most untutored being, and placed himself squarely beneath Washington's authority as an aspiring general officer. Henry Knox was also a gifted amateur, a Boston bookseller, well-read in engineering, whom Washington plucked from the ranks to head an artillery regiment. He demonstrated his resourcefulness in December 1775 by transporting the British cannon captured at Ticonderoga over the ice and snow on 40 sleds driven by 80 yoke of oxen to the Cambridge encampment. Like Greene, he worshipped the ground Washington walked on. Both Greene and Knox were subsequently showered with glory, Knox living on to become Washington's Secretary of War in the 1790s. The pattern is reasonably clear. Washington recruited military talent wherever he could find it, and he had a knack for discovering ability in unlikely places and then allowing it to ride the same historical wave he was riding into the American pantheon. But he was extremely protective of his own authority. While he did not encourage sycophants, if dissenters ever broached their criticism out of doors, as both Lee and Gates ended up doing, he was usually unforgiving. One could make a plausible case, and several scholars have done so, that Washington's insistence on personal loyalty was rooted in his insecurity in the face of Lee's and Gates's superior military credentials. But the more compelling explanation is that he understood instinctively how power worked, and that his own quasi-monarchical status was indispensable to galvanize an extremely precarious cause. Moreover, as it turned out, his chief liability as a military strategist was not his sense of inferiority, but just the opposite. His special status as His Excellency fit him better than any of his old suits, and he was determined to protect it from tearing and shredding. Just as the standing army he sought to create contradicted the political principles it claimed to be fighting for, Washington's king-like status contradicted the potent anti-monarchical ethos in revolutionary ideology. In both cases, Washington acknowledged the incongruity, but preferred victory to consistency. From the very start, however, he made a point of insisting that his expansive mandate was dependent upon and subordinate to the will of the American citizenry as represented in the Continental Congress. His letters to John Hancock, the first president of the Congress, always took the form of requests rather than demands. And he established the same posture of official deference toward the New England governors and provincial governments that supplied troops for his army. Washington did not use the term civilian control, but he was scrupulous about acknowledging that his own authority derived from the elected representatives in the Congress. If there were two institutions that embodied the emerging nation to be called the United States, the Continental Army and the Continental Congress, he insisted that the former was subordinate to the latter. In truth, important precedents were being established on the fly during this first year of the war, as both Washington and the leadership in the Congress improvised on the edge of the imperial crisis. What, for example, should one call the army? Before the term Continental Army gained acceptance, the preferred term was the Army of the United Colonies of North America. The colonies had yet to become states, and the term American, which had been used as an epithet by Englishmen to describe the provincial creatures on the western periphery of the British Empire, still retained its negative connotation. When Washington approved the design for a Union flag, it looked eerily similar to the Union Jack. So when first hoisted over Cambridge in January 1776, the British troops inside Boston cheered, thinking it signaled surrender. The first official manifestation of civilian control occurred in October 1775, when a delegation from the Continental Congress that included Benjamin Franklin met with Washington and his staff in Cambridge to approve troop requests for an army of 20,372 men. Strictly speaking, the Continental Army did not exist until the start of the new year. Until then, Washington was commanding a collection of provincial militia units whose enlistments ran out in December 1775. Politically speaking, the endorsement of Washington's troop requests by the Continental Congress was deceptively encouraging, since compliance depended on approval by the respective state governments, which insisted that all recruits be volunteers and serve limited terms of no more than 1 year. And, logistically speaking, the vaunted principles of state sovereignty, volunteerism, and limited enlistments, all expressions of revolutionary conviction, produced a military turnstile that bedeviled Washington throughout the war. Instead of a hard core of experienced veterans, the Continental Army became a constantly fluctuating stream of amateurs, coming and going like tourists. "It is not in the pages of history, perhaps, to furnish a case like ours," Washington complained to Hancock. "To maintain a post within musket shot of the enemy for 6 months together, and at the same time to disband one army and recruit another within that distance of 20-odd British regiments." The very term Continental Army, then, implied a level of coherence and stability that was permanently at odds with the transitory collective he was commanding. In the first year of the war, when the revolutionary fires burned their brightest, Washington presumed that he would enjoy a surplus of recruits. In October 1775, a council of war voted unanimously to reject all slaves and by a great majority to reject Negroes altogether. The following month, Washington ordered that "neither Negroes, boys unable to bear arms, nor old men unfit to endure the fatigues of the campaign are to be enlisted." But within a few months, as it became clear that there would not be enough new recruits to fill the ranks as the militia units disbanded, he was forced to change his mind. "It has been represented to me," he wrote Hancock, "that the free Negroes who have served in this army are very much dissatisfied at being discarded, and it is to be apprehended that they may seek employ in the ministerial army. I have presumed to depart from the resolution respecting them, and have given license for them being enlisted. If this is disapproved of by Congress, I will put a stop to it." In this backhanded fashion, Washington established the precedent for a racially integrated Continental Army, except for a few isolated incidents, the only occasion in American military history when blacks and whites served alongside one another in integrated units until the Korean War. Finally, the Siege of Boston afforded the first extended glimpse at Washington's cast of mind as a military strategist. His motives for supporting American independence were always more elemental than refined. Essentially, he saw the conflict as a struggle for power in which the colonists, if victorious, destroyed British presumptions of superiority and won control over half a continent for themselves. While it would be somewhat excessive to say that his central military goal was an equally elemental urge to smash the British army in one decisive battle, there was a discernible mano-a-mano dimension to his thinking, a tendency to regard each engagement as a personal challenge to his own honor and reputation. At Cambridge, it took the form of several risky offensive schemes to dislodge the British regulars once it became clear that Howe was unwilling to come out from behind his Boston redoubts and face him in open battle. On three occasions, in September 1775, then again in January and February 1776, Washington proposed frontal assaults against the British defenses, arguing that a stroke well aimed at this critical juncture might put a final end to the war. In one of the plans, he envisioned a night attack across the ice with advance units wearing ice skates. His staff rejected each proposal on the grounds that the Continental Army lacked both the size and the discipline to conduct such an attack with sufficient prospects for success. Eventually, Washington accepted a more limited tactical scheme to occupy Dorchester Heights, which placed Howe's garrison within range of American artillery, thereby forcing Howe's decision to evacuate or see his army slowly destroyed. But throughout the siege, Washington kept looking for a more direct and conclusive battle, suggesting that he himself was ready for a major engagement, even if his army was not. His most aggressive proposal, which was adopted, called for a separate campaign against Quebec. Once it was clear that Howe did not intend to oblige him by coming out of Boston, Washington decided to detach 1,200 troops from his Cambridge camp and send them up the Kennebec River into Canada under the command of a young colonel named Benedict Arnold. Washington's thinking about the importance of the Canadian theater reflected his memories of the French and Indian War, in which Canadian forts had been strategic keys to victory, as well as his belief that the stakes in the current war included the entire eastern half of North America. As he put it to Arnold, "I need not mention to you the great importance of this place and the consequent possession of all Canada in the scale of American affairs. To whomsoever it belongs, in their favor, probably, will the balance turn." By capturing Quebec, Arnold would restore the only link wanting in the great chain of continental union. However conventional his thinking about Quebec's strategic significance, Washington's commitment to a Canadian campaign was recklessly bold. Arnold's force had to traverse 350 miles of the most difficult terrain in New England during the outset of the winter snows. Within a month, the troops were eating their horses, dogs, and moccasins, dying by the scores from exposure and disease. It is difficult to imagine such a campaign ever being contemplated later in the war, but at this early stage, Washington shared the prevalent belief that patriotic fervor, combined with sheer courage, could defeat the elements and the odds. Despite truly heroic efforts by Arnold and his troops, the Canadian campaign exposed the illusory character of Washington's convictions. After linking up with a force commanded by General William Montgomery as planned, Arnold's depleted army made a desperate night assault on Quebec in a blinding snowstorm on December 31, 1775. The result was a catastrophic defeat, both Arnold and Montgomery falling in the first minutes of the battle. Arnold suffered a serious leg wound but survived, while Montgomery had his face shot off and died on the spot. If Canada was the key, the British now held it more firmly than before. The Quebec debacle was a decisive blow, but not the kind Washington had intended. Finally, the Cambridge chapter revealed another Washington trait that has not received sufficient attention in the existent scholarship because it is only indirectly connected to military strategy. Historians have long known that more than two-thirds of the American casualties in the war were the result of disease. But only recently, and this is rather remarkable, have they recognized that the American Revolution occurred within a virulent smallpox epidemic of continental scope that claimed about 100,000 lives. Washington first encountered the epidemic outside Boston, where he learned that between 10 and 30 funerals were occurring each day because of the disease. British troops, though hardly impervious to the smallpox virus, tended to possess greater immunity because they came from English, Scottish, and Irish regions where the disease had existed for generations, allowing resistance to build up within families over time. The soldiers in the Continental Army, on the other hand, tended to come from previously unexposed farms and villages, so they were extremely vulnerable. At any point in time between one-fourth and one-fifth of Washington's army at Cambridge was unfit for duty, the majority down with smallpox. Quite probably, Arnold's force at Quebec was also decimated by the disease in the weeks before the fatal attack. Washington, of course, was immune to smallpox because of his youthful exposure in Barbados. Subsequent admirers claimed that he was immune to everything. Equally important, he understood the ravaging implications of a smallpox epidemic within the congested conditions of his encampment, and he quarantined the patients in a hospital at Roxbury. When the British began their evacuation of Boston in March 1776, he ordered that only troops with pockmarked faces be allowed into the city. And although many educated Americans opposed inoculation, believing that it actually spread the disease, Washington strongly supported it. It would take 2 years before inoculation became mandatory for all troops serving in the Continental Army, but the policy began to be implemented in the first year of the war. When historians debate Washington's most consequential decisions as commander-in-chief, they are almost always arguing about specific battles. A compelling case can be made that his swift response to the smallpox epidemic and to a policy of inoculation was the most important strategic decision of his military career. After lingering in the Boston harbor for over a week, the British fleet sailed away on March 27, 1776. The American press reported the retreat as a crushing blow to the British Army. The Continental Congress ordered a gold medallion cast in Washington's honor. Harvard College awarded him an honorary degree. And John Hancock predicted that he had earned a conspicuous place in the Temple of Fame, which shall inform posterity that under your directions, an undisciplined band of husbandmen in the course of a few months became soldiers, defeating an army of veterans commanded by the most experienced generals. While uplifting, subsequent events would soon show that this was an overly optimistic appraisal. Panorama. As Washington took his army south from Boston to New York in the spring of 1776, the Continental Congress moved closer to declaring American independence, and a British fleet carrying 33,000 soldiers and sailors, the largest expeditionary force yet to cross the Atlantic, moved closer to the American coastline. The conjunction of these two dramatic developments virtually assured that the formerly remote prospects for a peaceful reconciliation were now gone altogether. One of the great ironies embedded in that propitious moment, available to us only in retrospect, was that widespread support for what Washington described as the American cause was, in fact, cresting, and would never again reach the height it achieved during the Boston siege. The spirit of 76 should be more accurately, if less lyrically, be called the spirit of late 75 and early 76, because patriotic fervor began to erode just as the war became politically official and militarily threatening. Though Washington himself never wavered, in the end, steadfastness was his most valuable attribute, along with the stamina that accompanied it, popular enthusiasm for the war faded alongside the illusion that it would be a brief affair. The mythological rendition of dedicated citizen soldiers united for 8 years in the fight for American liberty was, in fact, a romantic fiction designed by later generations to conceal the deep divisions and widespread apathy within the Patriot camp. The fundamental strategic challenge facing Washington was to fight a conventional war against the British Army in the midst of a civil war for the hearts and minds of the American people. And the very term American people suggests a national collective that was still in the process of being born. If we are to properly assess his achievement, we need to fully understand his predicament after the Boston phase. That means moving to a higher elevation from which to scan the historical terrain more panoramically than anyone on the ground could manage at the time. Why was that huge British fleet sailing toward the American coast? The obvious answer is that George III and his chief ministers, Lord North and Lord George Germain, had decided to crush the rebellion with one massive projection of British military power. But since, at least in retrospect, this decision has gone down as one of the biggest blunders in the history of British statecraft, and since, again in retrospect, the ingredients for a viable political solution to the imperial crisis were clearly present from 1774 onward, why did the ministry regard war as its only option? The political solution had been offered by the Continental Congress in 1774 and again in 1775. 3 years later, after the disastrous defeat at Saratoga, Lord North proposed essentially the same solution: freedom from Parliament's authority over colonial domestic affairs in return for continued economic membership in the British Empire. But by then, it was too late. This principle of shared or overlapping sovereignty between the home government and peripheral states eventually became the political framework for the British Commonwealth, and before that, the federal idea at the core of the American Constitution. By embracing it in 1775, the British government would have prolonged American membership in the British Empire until well into the next century, and avoided the American Revolution. And American history would have flowed forward in a direction that took little, if any, account of George Washington. More recent American history should allow us to comprehend more empathically the reasons for the fatal British miscalculation. In the late 18th century, Great Britain was a newly arrived world power, still learning how to manage its recently acquired empire. A version of the domino theory haunted all the ministry's deliberations. If the American colonies were granted political autonomy over their domestic affairs, then Canada, Ireland, and the British Caribbean possessions would surely demand equivalent status, and the entire empire, India included, would gradually unravel. Military advisors tended to view the looming conflict through the prism of the French and Indian War, where the British Army captured French forts at the strategic strong points, such as Louisbourg, Quebec, and Pittsburgh, and won a decisive victory, all the while developing only contempt for the fighting prowess of American militia. The Earl of Sandwich informed the ministry that, based on his experience, 1,000 British regulars could defeat 100,000 provincial troops. Dissenting voices warned that the lessons of the French and Indian War were irrelevant, since there were no strategic strong points that, once captured, produced a decisive conclusion. Lord Camden, for example, cautioned his colleagues in Parliament that the British Army would find itself adrift in a boundless sea of troubles. To conquer a great continent of 1,800 miles containing 3 millions of people seems an undertaking not to be rashly engaged in. But such dissenters were ignored. The best and brightest minds in the government were confident that the bulk of the American population were loyal to the king, and that, whether loyal or not, the British Army was invincible. In short, the arrogance of British power should strike a chord that is eerily and painfully familiar to students of the American Empire in its own formative phase, most especially its 20th century commitment in Southeast Asia. For our present purposes, the most salient point is that the British commitment represented the ministry's misguided but deeply felt conviction that the very future of the British Empire was at stake. This conviction would continue to animate the highest echelons of the government long after British popular opinion had grown weary of the war, and even after a succession of battlefield setbacks had demonstrated that the war was unwinnable in any traditional sense of the term. Conventional wisdom is that space and time were on the American side. But no one in 1776 fully appreciated how long the British ministry was prepared to stay the course, or how quickly the revolutionary fires would subside and in several regions of America nearly die out completely. It was a recipe for a protracted war of attrition. What were the major military advantages and disadvantages facing the British Army? On the positive side, it possessed two enormous assets. First, it enjoyed nearly total naval supremacy, which meant that all the major American cities, Boston, Newport, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Charleston, were vulnerable to destruction and occupation. It also meant that in any engagements along the coast or on coastal rivers, the British Army possessed superior mobility. Second, although the Earl of Sandwich's estimate of British military prowess was wildly exaggerated, the discipline and combat experience of British regulars gave them a decisive advantage on any battlefield where they were not greatly outnumbered, especially in any open field battle conducted along the orthodox lines of European warfare. On the negative side, the British Army was an ocean away from its logistical base of operations, which not only created problems of resupply, but also meant that it could ill afford to suffer heavy casualties, since replacements could not be produced easily or quickly. But the major problem was suggested by the Earl of Camden's warning about the sheer vastness of the American theater. Rather than dissipate its force in a futile attempt at occupying terrain, the British commanders needed to identify and then destroy the strategic center of the rebellion. Veterans of the French and Indian War first thought that the proper target was that corridor along the Hudson River from Montreal to New York City, which, once captured and controlled, would effectively cut off New England from the middle and southern colonies. We can never know if this assessment was correct, because the campaign to achieve that goal failed spectacularly at Saratoga, the pivotal battle in the war. The other option, which turned out to be the only strategic target certain to produce a decisive outcome, was not a piece of ground. It was the Continental Army itself. What were Washington's chief options? The British Expeditionary Force cruising toward New York meant that all presumptions of a quick resolution based on London's willingness to meet the American peace terms were now gone forever. This left Washington to choose among three courses of action. First, he could take the Continental Army over the Alleghenies and avoid any full-scale engagements in favor of hit-and-run guerrilla tactics, thereby forcing the British Army to pursue him in the wilderness or wander up and down the coast conducting marauding operations against local militia. Second, he could fight what was called a war of posts, meaning a series of tactical engagements and withdrawals designed to inflict casualties on the British Army but not risk his own troops in one all-or-nothing battle. Third, he could confront the British directly with his entire force and risk the consequences of a major battle, preferably on terrain favorable to a strong defensive position that forced the British to make frontal attacks in the Bunker Hill mode. Washington never gave the first option any serious consideration. He regarded flight to the western frontier as a desperate last resort only after his army had suffered a major setback. One of his generals, Charles Lee, favored this option, but Washington opposed it for two reasons. First, moving to the west was, as he saw it, flight, and he wanted to fight. Second, granting the British Army a free hand throughout the most densely populated coastal region meant trusting in the fighting prowess of the militia, and Washington had no faith in militia as independent fighting units. The second option also struck him as a more diluted form of cowardice, a decision to avoid the British challenge that verged on dishonorable behavior. It also, in effect, meant sacrificing New York, and then Philadelphia, and wherever else the British Army chose to march, to enduring occupation, which would give additional courage to the Loyalists and push the neutrals toward at least a temporary British affiliation. He also worried about the political reaction in the Continental Congress, and more generally in the populace at large, to a defensive strategy that seemed to acknowledge the superiority of British arms. That left the third option, at once the most dangerous strategically and the most appealing personally. Washington, in fact, never hesitated. In June 1776, while Jefferson was drafting the words that declared American independence and the principles on which it claimed to be based, Washington was moving his 15,000 troops into positions on Long Island and Manhattan in preparation for a major engagement with the larger British force commanded by General William Howe and his older brother, Admiral Richard Howe. This bold decision flowed directly out of his own personality, which welcomed the opportunity to demonstrate its contempt for British pretensions of supremacy. If there was an excellent fit between his quasi-monarchical powers as commander-in-chief and his psychic chemistry. There was an equally poor fit between the strategic options in 1776 and the impulses of his character. Washington's decision, in fact, presented the British commanders with a golden opportunity to destroy the Continental Army at the start of the war. Enamored throughout the Boston siege with the prospects for a quick American victory, Washington had placed the Continental Army in the most vulnerable position possible and created the conditions for dramatic defeat. Trying men's souls. It would have been difficult to imagine a more perfect place for the British Army to confront and crush the Continental Army than New York City. Strategically, it was the southern entrance to the Hudson Corridor, which, once occupied, sealed off New England from the other rebellious colonies. Topographically, it was tailor-made for the kind of amphibious operations that British naval supremacy made possible, and that Washington's force could only contemplate in its dreams. Politically, both Long Island and Manhattan were hotbeds for loyalists prepared to greet the Howe brothers as conquering heroes. Small wonder, then, that on July 2nd and 3rd, 1776, the very days the Continental Congress voted to approve American independence and revised the language of Jefferson's draft declaring this revolutionary act, the advance elements of Lord Howe's fleet of 30 warships and 400 transport vessels began pouring troops onto Staten Island. It was the largest military force ever assembled on the North American continent, and the largest army the British would ever gather in one place during the entire war. In late May, Washington had traveled down to Philadelphia to consult with the Continental Congress about strategy. Martha went along and, under prodding from her husband, underwent smallpox inoculation in Jefferson's old quarters. The consultation produced two decisions. First, Washington would make a maximum effort to defend New York, and second, a board of war and ordnance would be created, with John Adams as its chairman, to facilitate coordination between the Congress and the Army. Though outnumbered, and with nearly a quarter of his soldiers ill with smallpox despite his best efforts to contain the epidemic, Washington was confident he could produce a victory, or at the least inflict sufficient casualties to repeat the Bunker Hill experience for Howe. "If our troops will behave well," he apprised John Hancock, "having everything to contend for that freemen hold dear, they, Howe's troops, will have to wade through much blood and slaughter before they can carry any part of our works, if they carry 'em at all." As the British build-up on Staten Island continued, Washington's orders reflected the revolutionary conviction that the purity of the cause, combined with sheer courage under fire, would more than compensate for inferior numbers and inexperience. "Remember, officers and soldiers, that you are free men, fighting for the blessings of liberty, that slavery will be your portion and that of posterity, if you do not acquit yourselves like men." How much of this rhetoric Washington himself believed is unclear. His letters to Hancock are more circumspect, predicting that the enemy will not succeed in their views without considerable loss. What is clear is that Washington believed that his own personal honor, bound tightly to the course of independence now officially declared, left him no choice but to fight. Sighting, July 20th, 1776. An aide to General Howe, Lieutenant Colonel James Patterson has been admitted behind American lines to confer with Washington. Patterson carries a document from Howe purporting to offer peace terms that will avoid further bloodshed. The document is addressed to George Washington, Esquire, etc., etc., etc. Washington's staff had already apprised Patterson that no such document could be delivered, because no such person existed to receive it, the only Washington in camp being His Excellency General Washington. Patterson regrets that General Howe cannot recognize that title without endorsing the legitimacy of the rebellion. But he is eventually admitted to an hour-long interview with the American Commander-in-Chief, in which he relates the content of the document. Washington explains that the document is addressed to a private person, which is no longer who he is, and that the designation, etc., 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 implied everything and also implied anything. Furthermore, General Howe appeared empowered only to grant pardons, and those who had committed no fault wanted no pardon. Patterson is then escorted back to his barge, disappointed but sociable and chatty all the way. As the British prepared for an assault on Long Island, Washington issued orders describing our glorious cause and contrasting the motivation of dedicated patriots to mere mercenaries. Smallpox continued to ravage his regiments, leaving several units without field-grade officers. He probably sensed the coming disaster, but felt obliged to maintain a public posture of confidence. On the eve of the battle, he wrote a long letter to Lund, Washington, searching for relief from his apprehensions by issuing orders about where to plant cherry and locust trees at Mount Vernon and which horses to sell. Back in Philadelphia, John Adams wrote to his beloved Abigail, "The eyes of the world are upon Washington and Howe and their armies." What the world witnessed was a humiliating American defeat. Long Island was lost in a day, along with 300 casualties and 1,000 prisoners. By dividing his force between Manhattan and Long Island, Washington had presented Howe with the opportunity to destroy the Continental Army in pieces. Asked to explain the defeat, Adams put it succinctly, "In general, our generals were outgeneraled." Washington's only redeeming action was the rescue of surviving units from Brooklyn Heights under the cover of fog and rain on the night of August 29th. But that was only the half of it. The remainder of his army on Manhattan was now vulnerable to entrapment once Howe transported troops up the East River and cut off his escape route on the peninsula. The ever-realistic General Greene urged a quick evacuation. "I give it as my opinion that a general and speedy retreat is absolutely necessary, and that the honor and interest of America requires it. I would burn the city and its suburbs." Topography, British mobility, and Washington's own inexperience had combined to place the entire Continental Army at risk of annihilation. Upon hearing from her husband that Howe was poised to close the trap that would destroy Washington's beleaguered force, Abigail Adams remained defiant. "Even if all America's brave men were killed or captured," she declared, "the British Army would find itself opposed by a race of Amazons in America." Then, a very strange thing happened. Washington called a council of war in which its generals voted 10-3 in favor of Greene's recommendation for an evacuation of Manhattan as soon as possible. But Washington rejected the advice. As he reported to Hancock, His officers had urged him to adopt a defensive strategy, to fight what they called a war of posts. But despite the recent setbacks and losses, he remained committed to the offense and victory. New York remained the key to the northern country, and a wholesale retreat would reflect badly on him as well as on what he called the common cause. All these negative consequences would be offset if a brilliant stroke could be made with any probability of success, especially after our loss upon Long Island. He would then maintain his army on the northern edge of Manhattan at Harlem Heights, wait for the chance to pounce, and, if eventually forced to withdraw, inflict heavy casualties as he retreated. It was as if a mouse cornered by a bevy of cats had declared itself a lion. As several generations of historians have noted, Washington's decision to linger on Manhattan was militarily inexplicable and tactically suicidal. A letter back home to Lund suggests that Washington was aware of the risks he was running and preferred to go down fighting rather than acknowledge defeat. Again, he saw the war in highly personal terms. "I see the impossibility of serving with reputation," he wrote to Lund, "and yet I am told that if I quit the command, inevitable ruin will follow. If I fall, it may not be amiss that these circumstances be known. And if the men stand by me, which, by the by, I despair of, I am resolved not to be forced from this ground while I have life." Ultimately, Washington's army and life were spared because General Howe also behaved inexplicably. Perhaps because he saw himself primarily as a peace negotiator instead of a general, or perhaps for reasons only fathomable by psychiatrists, Howe did not close the trap around the Continental Army. He dallied, and then focused his efforts on capturing Fort Washington, near the present-day George Washington.